From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's the setup to Matthew Green's play now running in Salt Lake City. Curtis is gay and Mormon, just got back from his honeymoon, and he's received a letter in the mail from his stake president. He's been summoned to a church court for marrying a man. He's not sure he wants to show up, but he does. It's a one-man show, one actor playing one man facing 15 others. It's called Good Standing. We'll be right back.
Is something missing from your morning breakfast or evening dinner prep? How about NPR's critically acclaimed sound-rich stories alongside KUER's in-depth local news? Now with smart speakers, listening just became a whole lot easier. Tell Alexa or your Google Home to play NPR, and they'll take you right to KUER's live stream. Unlock the world of public radio with just your voice by telling Alexa or Google to play NPR, and never get stuck in the driveway again.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In Matthew Green's new play for Plan B Theater Company, now running in Salt Lake City, Curtis Scott Brown has decided he's going to show up for his Mormon church disciplinary court. Not everyone does. By the time the letter comes in the mail, a lot of people are just finished with the church or know what the outcome will be. And it's not like you go to jail if you don't appear before this council of leaders from the ward and stake. Curtis Brown says in the play, he figures they all have their minds made up already, that this is an open and shut case, that he is a sinner. He doesn't deny the love he has for his husband, doesn't deny he's wanted to be with a man for as long as he can remember. Curtis has just gotten married, just got back from his honeymoon, in fact, and he's been summoned to this court, and he's decided to show up. He has his reasons, one in particular. Today in the program, we're talking about the play. It's called Good Standing. Matthew Green is joining us. He's a playwright based in New York. Good Standing is his second production with Plan B Theater Company. His first was called Adam and Steve and the Empty Sea. He's joining us today from a studio in New York. And Matthew Green, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, good to be here.
I wanted to begin, you said, when people ask you what you're trying to say with a play, that you try and answer in terms of what you're trying to not say, but ask. I wanted to start there. Explain what you mean about that, and I want to get to the questions you're trying to ask with Good Standing.
Yeah, I think in general, I'm more of an asker than a proclaimer. I tend to want to explore complicated things and find nuance and gray area. I also find that theater as an artistic medium is a really effective way of inviting conversation and asking questions. It's a neutral space where we all gather to sort of digest a story and digest a work of art together as a community. And so I find it much more interesting as a writer to focus on what are the questions that I want to pose to audience members, and what are the questions that I want audience members to be walking out of the play
asking themselves
yeah. and each other. And yeah.
You know, it's interesting. One of the few of the questions that you were working through with Adam and Steve, I mentioned that play, I teased these out. Should personal convictions ever supersede a human relationship? That was one. And this one, it was interesting. What happens when you lose something you believe in? So these are really big kind of existential questions that you're working through. What were the questions for Good Standing? Was there one you had teased out?
What's interesting is that first question, the should personal belief ever supersede human relationships, yeah. is, I think, really at the core of it. But I think Good Standing takes it one step further, which is how can you reconcile the space that's opened up between individuals when personal belief creates space, when a conflict of belief and identity, and when those spaces are created, how do you, first of all, deal with the pain that causes because of a lack of connection? And how do you work toward reestablishing that connection and building that connection again?
So this gives us a chance to sort of set up what this play is about. Matthew Green, give us a sense of this. Basically, what's happening is Curtis Brown has just gotten married to a man. He's gay,
right.
Mormon. And he's just received this letter to come to this disciplinary court.
The disciplinary councils for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church, are sort of these very interestingly theatrical, sort of ceremonial, performative events, like a lot of things in sort of religious life. And so that as a conceit already was interesting to me. I think at their best, the idea behind it could be that it's an opportunity to empathize with and understand people who are, in your eyes, transgressing and trying to understand their point of view.
Yeah. And at least that's in theory how it's supposed to work.
In
right?
theory, yeah. it would yeah. be great if that's what happened. I think oftentimes fear and prejudice and a desire for power and a desire for protecting normalcy often prevent that from being the case in those councils. But theater also is a laboratory for empathy, and it's an opportunity to try and understand someone else and try and get inside the heads and walk inside the shoes of people who are making choices that are surprising or upsetting or something like that.
Let me get Jerry Rapier involved in the conversation. He's Plan B's artistic director. He's directing Good Standing. He's joining us here in the studio. And Jerry, welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's further along this plot. So basically there's one actor on the stage.
Yes.
And he is portraying Curtis, who's received this letter and who's shown up for this disciplinary council that Matthew was mentioning. And he's dealing with a group of men, 15 other men.
Yes, so the three members of the stake presidency and then the 12 members of the high council, six of which have been assigned to speak on his behalf and six of which have been assigned to speak on behalf of the quote-unquote charges that are being brought against him.
What interests you about this conceit? I think what's interesting, and we'll talk about this with Matthew too, is that it's not judgy. Like, they're not judging these men. You don't get a sense of real anger, although there are kind of bursts or moments of that. He's not making fun of them, really. He's really getting them in the minds of these men, and that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I think ultimately that's the power of the play. In my own mind, preparing for rehearsal, I kept circling back to this idea that we tend to, as a species, assume that we know what everyone else is thinking all the time, specifically about us and specifically in relation to what we hold to be dear and truthful.
Yeah.
But we're almost always wrong.
Yeah.
And it creates unbelievable angst and drama and anxiety and fear. And in my experience, having left the Mormon Church 20 years ago, I have never been angry. I just said, this thing did not work out for me, and it works for you, and that's great.
More power to you, not for me.
Yes. Yeah. But I don't feel that way anymore.
Yeah.
I have had a big shift in my point of view in the last year. Part of it is being a parent, being a gay parent, and my same-sex marriage, which we call a marriage.
You mean you don't qualify it?
Yeah, we don't put the same-sex qualifier at the beginning of everything we do.
Right.
And I'm thinking very differently about how these pieces fit together of my life.
So before you were like, it's cool, do what you want. But you're like, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm angry now.
I wouldn't say that it's cool.
Yeah.
It's just that I didn't grow up in Utah.
Yep.
And I think that's a huge element of the layers of pain that go into the gay Mormon experience specific to Utah. There's so many more layers to peel back. And I grew up in a place where there were a lot of Mormons, but it wasn't predominantly Mormon. There were lots of other people around with lots of points of view. And I didn't feel as stifled and as afraid of making my choice to leave. And I didn't feel the immediate separation from a culture as well.
Yeah.
The faith and the culture were two different things for me. And here it's so intertwined and it's so hard to pull those threads apart. But I'm also really tired of people telling me that they have an opinion that matters more than mine about the structure of and the health of my family. And I think that's where my anger comes from now. I'm kind of late to the anger party.
So, but why then is this play appealing to you? Because it's not angry. It does have a kind of open perspective. We are hearing these white male Mormon men expressing their orthodox opinions. So why is that appealing to you now?
Because I'm a little more open to people's anger.
Huh.
And that gives me the need to also figure out how to process my own anger that is new to me.
Wow, that's interesting.
And what Matt has done so beautifully with this play is all of it, even the things that he, as a playwright and gay man, completely disagree with on a human level, he's created these men with love and with care. And I think ultimately we could all use a little bit more of that. And maybe if we could actually approach situations like this with love and with openness and the idea that there is something to learn from each side, then maybe there would be less anger to process.
Hmm. So, Matthew, you're not feeling a sense – you've said this isn't – you don't come at this with a sense of resentment necessarily. There's something else going on here. What is the idea behind giving voice to these particular men as they're trying to judge this gay man before them?
Big part of the reason why I wrote the play was as a way of working through my own anger and confusion and resentment and and just sort of the deep hurt that was going on as a former Mormon who came out, like over the, sort of throughout that journey, a lot of that negativity had built up. And this was a way of reclaiming the world I've come from and trying to understand it better, but also really trying to go on this dramaturgical journey to understand and love these people who I had been demonizing as a result of this big change. I've done this before as a writer. I find that the tension between my own beliefs and prejudices and the tension between that and a character that I have deliberately created to be at odds with the things I believe, I find that process really exciting as a person and as an artist because it forces me to get outside my comfort zone and write these things. So interestingly, this play that very deliberately isn't angry and it's not a polemic and it's not a didactic attack on the Mormon church started out because that's what was in my head. That's what was in my heart at the time, and I needed to work through it.
It's interesting to hear you say, and as I have read, you have said that it's an autobiographical play, even though you yourself haven't actually stood in front of a disciplinary council
right.
and stared down, 15 men. But nor have you you just sort of left. You didn't really get a letter. You didn't have them. So how is it right. autobiographical? You're just sort of imagining yourself in that situation?
Yeah, the word I've coined is auto-hypothetical because the ingredients of the play are all very true to life. These 15 men are 15 men that I know, and some of them are amalgams of different people, and some of them are based on women who I knew. Not very many, but there are just a lot of voices that made their way in. And Curtis Scott Brown is a very thinly veiled avatar for Matthew Scott Green. But as far as my own journey and how it differed, I was never called into a disciplinary council. Part of that is because I haven't been married yet. And it was an interesting process of I walked out of the church and just sort of left very decisively. I was sort of thorough about that decision, and it was the right thing to do. And I walked out, and I very soon thereafter told friends and family that I was doing that and didn't really feel a need to make anything official until I was working on this play. And it was actually really shortly before the play opened that I officially resigned from the LDS Church and asked to have my name removed from the records. And I didn't think that was going to be as big a moment as it was. And it ended up really causing this paradigm shift for me, and it felt like a really healing moment and a way of moving forward and a way of stepping away and letting go a lot of resentment and sort of just getting some closure and severing the ties. And that was something that I didn't totally expect I would do, but working on this play brought that about in my own life.
Matthew Green, he wrote the play Good Standing. Austin Archer performs the one-man show, and Jerry Rapier is directing the production. It runs through Sunday. You can get all that information on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Do you work for the University of Utah? Are you a public radio nerd? Then donate to KUER through payroll deduction. Decide how much of your paycheck you'd like to put toward programming like Morning Edition, 1A, and Radio West, and the university will send your generous gift to KUER. Your contribution supports factual journalism, Utah stories, and even short films. Get started with payroll deduction by looking under the support tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the latest production from Plan B Theater Company. And here's the setup. Curtis is gay and Mormon. He's just gotten back from his honeymoon, and he's received a letter in the mail from his stake president. He's been summoned to a church court for marrying a man. He's not sure he wants to show up, but he does. The play is called Good Standing. It's running through the weekend in Salt Lake City. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. We have with us the playwright Matthew Green, the actor. This is a one-man show. The actor, Austin Archer, and Jerry Rapier, who directs the production. It's interesting you mentioned the characters being kind of an amalgam of people you actually know. And I wondered, Jerry, I want to hear you on this, and we'll get to Austin Archer here in a moment because he has to play all these men. But are they all of a type? Because it seems like there's the Mormon progressive. There's the still closeted gay man but active Mormon. There's the kindly Sunday school teacher who's Orthodox but kind of self-aware. There's the kind of the old fart, you know, sickened by the gays and how unnatural. You know, there's the conflicted but father who's determined to not compromise. I mean, are they all of a kind of type that we see in this religious experience, do you think?
Well, interestingly, our lighting designer, Matt Taylor, who's from the South and just moved here a couple of years ago, he teaches at UVU now, he commented in rehearsal, I don't know any of these men, I don't know anything about Mormonism, but I know all of these men because they're from my Southern Baptist upbringing. Huh. It's a very fine line to say that these men are types because obviously they're very much individual humans with their own complete stories. But we did find this common language. My upbringing, I know all these people in my own ward in Duncan, Arizona. And Matt clearly knows them. They're drawn from directly from his own life, but Austin and I never really had a huge conversation about character because they're also the men from his ward and from his childhood. So they're not types in the traditional sense, I would say, but these are the kinds of people that populate any kind of religious group, I think. Not everybody's cookie cutter and identical. And what I find, the line that haunts me from the play is thou shalt keep thy mouth shut, the 11th commandment. The idea that you can feel anything, but you don't voice what you feel unless it's the cookie cutter response. And I think that's what Matt has magically created in this play, is captured as what the tension that arises when you can't speak what you know to be your own truth. Just for a minute, I wondered, how do you make 15 men that most people would say would on the surface be identical,
yep,
different and compelling on stage, But then we read the play the first day in rehearsal, and then I was like, Austin's got this. That's how you do it.
Well, let's introduce Austin Archer. Please, all the characters in the show. This is a one-man show. This is his acting debut with Plan B Theater Company. He wrote Jump last year, which Plan B did perform. And Austin Archer, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Is it hard playing? What is it? 16 characters, actually, right?
16 characters.
Yeah.
You know, the first time we read the script, it really seemed like I recognized the characters right away, and that's a testament to the writing and to the way that Matt's structured the specificity of these men. But they certainly jumped out at me as people that I grew up with, and I think that's what happens to the audience when they watch the show, is that they see members of their own community. And, you know, as an actor, you start with definitely archetype and general, and then move into more specifics. Yeah. But that's because that's how the audience starts too. You know, they want to get a general idea of who someone is, and then kind of personalize it and internalize it and make it personal to their story. So it wasn't necessarily my goal to try to exactly recreate the exact person from Matt's life, because it became an amalgam of one or two people from his life, a person from Jerry's life, and a person from mine. And then certainly when the audience comes in, they layer their person on top of it too.
Yeah.
And then it becomes this very real, very specific person.
But how did you do it just physically, transformationally? I mean, you couldn't do – they're all white men.
Yeah.
And one is old.
Yeah, it's not like one's from Ireland and one's
exactly. So what do you do? How did you do what did you have to find, like, honestly, like physical characteristics?
Yeah, you think of a one-man show, I'm going to put on hats, I'm going to take my mustache off, and, you know, we definitely wanted to steer clear of that early on, because they all come from more or less the same region. They're all middle-aged. They range from probably, you know, early 40s to 70s. So what it became was, for me at least, was placing their age was kind of a big thing, and where their voice sits. And then really I kind of found like a region in my voice for different types of people. Like some are higher, some are a little bit more back in my throat, and some are a little bit more forward. Some speak faster, some speak slower, some have reasons for speaking slower. Certain words are hard for them to say out loud. Certain thoughts are difficult for them to express. And so that really dictates the rhythm of how they speak. And then getting more specific about who they were in the rehearsal process really was kind of the final shaper of how they sounded and how they were portrayed.
How did your own experience, your own personal relationship with Mormonism, your own experience as a gay man, how did that affect the way you approached the characters?
Certainly, and I should say I'm not a gay man.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
Sorry.
That's
fascinating, though. Mm-hmm. I kind of assumed.
Well, you know, but I think the people, especially in this day and age, I think Jerry asked Matt, what's more important to you? Is it important to you to have a gay actor play the role? And Matt said, well, it's more important that he was raised LDS. And I think this show.
This automatic connection to an understanding of the nuance.
Is it actually
We're definitely in an age of representation and trying to make sure that characters are played. You know, like we're in the age of we want to make sure that if there's a gay character that it's played by a gay actor, and that we're not taking roles away from people who are underrepresented and underrepresented communities. But
the important part is the LDS part.
There's 16 characters in this show, and two of them that we know of are gay. And but they're all LDS, and they all have this very unique background. And so that became the more important identifier for the actor who would take on the part. But definitely there were times when we'd be talking about a character and we'd go, oh, that guy's a little bit more – he's a little bit kinder than, you know, maybe that I'm hitting on. And then I would – Jerry even saw me in rehearsal a few times. I'd be thinking, and I'd sort of do this smile to myself. And what I was doing was drawing up a guy from my ward going, oh, no, it's this guy. You know, and so I'd be trying to think of his face and his voice. And it was kind of funny to watch me roll through my little Rolodex of men that I grew up with. But they definitely are all there and certainly helped inform this and, certainly helped color in the characters.
I want to hear Austin perform. Let's start with Curtis. All these men, they're surprised that he shows up. without giving away a really important element. He does show up. Can you say why he's there without giving away too much, Matthew Greene?
I think it's a cathartic moment for Kurt to be in that room and to be standing in front of. There's a moment where he refers to one of the characters and says, he saw me through a lot of my awkward phases, or these, like, he's familiar with a lot of these men and is familiar with this room and this environment and this community. And I think there's something really freeing and important for Kurt to be standing in that space, occupying that space as his complete authentic self. One audience member actually said, she was telling me that she had done what I did. She had written her letter of resignation and asked to have her name removed. And she says, after seeing this play, I wish I had gone to the disciplinary council. I wish I had gone and stood there and had that moment. And that was a really powerful thing to hear, is that there is this moment of catharsis that Curtis has because he shows up.
Well, here's Austin Archer, who plays Curtis Brown in the play, Good Standing.
They ask me about my husband, and I'm not sure if it's just typical Mormon niceties or small talk, but I tell them he's from Connecticut, Jewish, works in finance, devastatingly handsome. The church said a couple years back, basically, if you get married, we don't want anything to do with you. But if you're just fooling around, just giving into temptation, there's still hope. But the second you want to be an adult about it, the second you want to bring love into the equation, you're going to stand trial. See, the church has been in this gray area with the whole gay issue. The Reader's Digest version, they disavowed reparative therapy, but then they fought like hell to pass Prop 8 in California. They made a website so gay Mormons wouldn't kill themselves, but they wrote a letter opposing the Supreme Court decision in 2015 and stated once again that church doctrine would never change. And then, you know, the coup de grace later that year, they made it clear just how unwelcome we all are. Church policy now states that the children of same-sex couples can't get baptized until they're 18 and, you know, presumably old enough to decide for themselves that they disavow their parents' relationship. Not only that, but these same-sex couples, just in case there was any question, were guilty of apostasy and needed to be, well, disciplined. Called into one of these courts of love, as they're called. Used to be that the church would settle these towns, and these disciplinary councils were the whole judicial branch of their communities or whatever. Swap out a bunch of old white guys for a bunch of other old white guys, and basically there you have it.
It's interesting, Matthew Greene, as we were talking about this earlier, I kind of wanted to hear you more on this, how you see these disciplinary councils as sort of Curtis lays them out as the kind of the judicial – they used to be the judicial branch of communities. But the fact that the ritual, there's a kind of patriarchal kind of performance going on, and there's a basic power imbalance, but they were designed to be exercises in empathy. So there's a lot going on in these councils, it seems like.
Yeah, I'm always impressed, and I do less of this reading now than I used to, but I was always impressed at how progressive and egalitarian the early Mormon church was, and what a sort of radical quasi-socialist Joseph Smith was. And that was always really impressive to me. And the fact that the judicial branch of Mormon communities, to a large extent, it was this empathetic body that called themselves a court of love that wanted to seek to understand. But like you said, there's an imbalance of power. And usually today, when someone is called into a disciplinary council, it's often someone who is a marginalized member of the community in some way. Mm-hmm. They are speaking to 15 of the most powerful people in that community. And the imbalance of power, I think, goes unacknowledged by a lot of people who are involved in these. There's a presumption that everyone's on a level playing field, but you know, for Kurt, for example, in the play, for a young gay man who's recently married, he's aware from the very beginning that he has zero power in this room. He even remarks at one point in the play, like, they're asking me questions as if they haven't already made up their minds. And so because of that imbalance of power, it's sort of, I think the ritual and the practice has moved away from its egalitarian roots. It's sort of progressive, let's all get in a room together and try and understand each other sort of underlying philosophy, and has become much more punitive. So, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of High Council members and stake presidents out there who would say, no, that's not how it is at all. But the fact is, when you're on one side of an imbalance of power, it's often hard to see that there is an imbalance of power.
I want to talk about Brother Keller. He's another one of the characters. He is Kurt's former bishop. Mm-hmm. And he's actually the first person Kurt comes out to when he's a kid. And I want to have you talk a little bit about this character, because there's a moment in this, in the play. I want to have Austin read this section here in a moment. But maybe, Jerry, could you set this up for us? This idea that this relationship about being worthy of love, I think this as a theme and this inner, this moment is interesting.
Well, in the world of the play, and this was very richly drawn directly from Matt's own life. But the bishop learns something from listening to someone that he would normally not listen to. And the incredible power that comes from actually doing what you say you do is undeniable. And he's doing the standard bishop's interview for temple worthiness, and he gets blindsided by the power of actually leading with his heart.
Yeah. Austin, read this section for us. This is Austin Archer again. This is a Brother Keller in the play, Good Standing.
There's this responsibility, and I know I shouldn't feel it, but this expectation for a bishop to have the right thing to say in a moment like that. So I tried to explain these were temptations like any other, and God must know how strong you are, Curtis, for giving you such a heavy cross to bear in this life. But he'd heard all that. He'd heard the answers. We were quiet for a moment, all that just hanging in the air while I finished the interview. Have there been any sins or misdeeds that should have been resolved with priesthood authorities that have not been? No. Do you consider yourself worthy to enter the Lord's house and participate in temple ordinances? I knew the questions by heart at this point. It seemed like Curtis did too. We finished the interview. I signed the recommend, and we said another prayer. And he was on his way out. But I had another question, one that's not on the list. Do you believe your Father in heaven loves you? Curtis looked at me and he didn't move. And it was like something inside of him broke open. That's how I described it to my wife that night, not using names, of course, but telling her how helpless I felt, because, see, I could sign the recommend and ask the questions and share whatever testimony I had, but here was a young man who didn't believe he was worthy of love. I cried that night. I'm not ashamed to admit it, and I like to think it was for the right reasons. What I could have said, what I wish he'd known. Another Sunday, a few months later, I was packing up my things and getting ready to go home, and Sundays are long days, you understand. All of a sudden, Curtis knocks on the door. No appointment, no warning. I was nervous. It was like stage fright, or like that sick feeling you get in your stomach when you're up to bat and the pitcher has that look in his eyes. What if I don't know what to say again? Curtis sat down and we said a prayer. He had this different look on his face. He almost hadn't come in. He'd met someone.
this former bishop, Brother Keller, starts to look forward to these meetings that he has with Kurt. And this is the part, Matthew Green, where you talk about how Kurt describes how love changes a person and how Keller, Brother Keller, learns a lesson about love. Like, he goes home and sees his wife differently. He feels love differently because he's seeing love in this, as he sees it, this kind of forbidden situation. But I wanted you to talk about it. He's just really moved by it, I guess.
Like Jerry said, this is very much drawn from a relationship I had with a bishop. And I don't know that this was sort of his inner, sure, his inner monologue. But the striking thing about that experience and the thing that caused me to write this, this was one of the first monologues in the play that I wrote, actually, was because the question, do you believe that God loves you? Him asking me that question, it was actually, to my recollection, the first time anyone had ever asked me that question. And I think it's fascinating that we have these worthiness interviews where we ask a bunch of questions that are relatively personal, but we don't ever get at that, which seems like such a core part of checking in on someone's spiritual well-being. But I don't write the rules. But I
just wrote the play.
Exactly. I just react to them. But I think the transformation that happens with Kurt that ends up really affecting Bishop Keller is seeing what it does to a person to experience love. And when I was going through my own coming out process, a really striking realization was that I was and had for as long as I could remember, making deliberate choices every day to not allow myself to feel love because I didn't feel like I was worthy of it. And so it was a very transformational thing. And, it, you know, not to diminish the importance of coming out and coming to terms with your sexuality and owning that part of yourself, but I found the experience of allowing myself to feel love and allowing myself to feel worthy of love was really the most important part of my coming out experience, and I think of Kurt's also. Mm-hmm. And I think that watching that for Bishop Keller, the character, is transformational, and it gets at the core of what love is. And he's able to look past any squeamishness or judgmental reaction to the fact that this is love between two men, and he thinks that that's sinful or he thinks that that's forbidden. It's not about that. He's able to look past that, and it affects the way that he connects with his wife and with his daughters and just and with God. And he's able to see love in its purest form and how that transforms somebody. I know that it was transformational in my life. I know that I'm sort of a night and day different person after being asked that question and really having to confront the fact, just like Kurt has to confront his answer to that question is, no, I don't believe that God loves me. I don't believe anyone could love me. I don't believe that. And why don't I believe that? And what do I have to change in order to believe that?
Yeah.
And that's the beginning of his journey, and it was the beginning of mine.
I don't think this next character requires much of a setup. This is Brother Isaacs. Here's Austin Archer reading Brother Isaacs from Good Standing.
I almost didn't show up, actually. My wife was the one. She said, you don't play sick from your priesthood duty. And I said, what if I'm not playing? What if I'm honest to goodness nauseated thinking about it? They say it was like this before 1978, actually, when the prophet got a revelation to give the priesthood to every worthy male, regardless of skin tone, which today seems crazy that that even had to. It was President Kimball, President Spencer W. Kimball, who actually had said some stuff about racial purity and interracial marriage, and then he got up and said they'd heard the voice of God, and it sounded remarkably like the voice of Martin Luther King did 15 years earlier. Though I'd never say something so blasphemous. Because this was a big, important moment for the church. And you hear all these people from that generation talk about how beautiful it was to see these white hands laid on the heads of these black men who just a few months earlier were being told that they were cursed with the mark of Cain, or that they didn't fight hard enough in the war in heaven, or whatever other fable it was that was being used to justify the outright, I mean, racism. Let's just call it what it was. Let's just, again, nauseated. But they say before that revelation came out that people were praying just with all their might for the church to be ready, I guess, for that change. The question, though, or at least my question, is what about the people who already were ready, waiting for the church to catch up to the rest of the world? Today's the same. What are you supposed to do when the thought of excommunicating someone for falling in love makes you legitimately sick and your wife has to talk you into tying your tie?
Jerry Rapier, say something about Isaac. I'm guessing this is expressing a point of view that we're hearing from a lot of people, just real ambivalence about what's going on, not wanting – this is the part that they don't like about being part of their church.
Yeah, and I love him because he – I think there's a lot more people like Brother Isaac's than we know because kind of going back to what I said earlier, this idea of what people feel and what they feel – able to express in the context of remaining part of their faith group are two very different things for more people than I think we, any of us, can understand. And he's trapped by his own feelings. I feel for him. He sees things just the way I do, except he wants to stay inside this particular group of people that I don't want to be a part of.
That idea of staying gets us to another character that I want to talk about, and this is President Spade. Matthew Green set this up for us because this is a really interesting character and a bit of a turn. I hope it's not giving too much away here.
No, I don't think it is, and I think the elephant in the room of any play about a gay Mormon man who leaves is that there are a lot of gay Mormon men who stay, some of whom are open and sort of own the fact that they have these same gender attraction feelings. And some of whom take the secret to their graves. But from a purely like dramaturgical standpoint, President Spade represents the life that Curtis could have led and by extension, the life that I could have led.
Yeah.
And he also is speaking about love. He has sacrificed a certain type of love. And I think it's a narrative that we hear a lot. He has sacrificed a certain type of love so that he can have another type of love. And he genuinely, honestly believes that he has made the right choice. And he knows that he's given something up. But I think there are a lot of people who have sacrificed authenticity and they have sacrificed sort of the messy, beautiful experience of being a human because of their sincerely held belief that this life is a trial and you have to get through it. And joy comes later. Hmm. So I think President Spade it was one of the hardest characters for me to sort of crawl inside of and occupy and feel charity and love for, because my first impulse is always to feel pity and frustration for people in this position, and that's not fair.
Here's the actor Austin Archer again playing President Spade from the play Good Standing.
I was good in high school. Straight A's, no speeding tickets, honored my mother and father. I guess I thought if I was good enough, I wouldn't need grace or the atonement. Because, see, I was broken, and I'd known it in one way or another for as long as I could remember. And it's not easy. I'm not saying that Kurt or I or anyone else had it easy. But I was good, like I'd said, and I'd never acted on it. I'd see a guy who I thought was attractive or that kind of thing, and I'd just shut it down. I'd turn away. And sometimes I'd let it go too far. I could have told Kurt that, too. No one's perfect. My mind would wander. I'd look for too long. I'd want the wrong things. And it was like all the light in my life was slipping away. And I'd kneel down and I'd pray. Same as anyone, same as any person who didn't have, who had different temptations. We don't flirt. We don't kiss. We just turn away. And I wish I'd talked to Kurt. I wish I'd told him that I've been there and I felt those things. There was a boy in high school and I left it behind me. There was another in college, two in college. I prayed my whole mission that this would be taken away from me. I prayed when I met my wife that I could love her. And when I kissed her for the first time, when I touched her and held her in my arms, it was like all the light in the world. I was bathing in it, feasting on it, filled with it. It was Easter Sunday and family home evening and Christmas lights in Temple Square. It was good, and it was warm, and it was what I wanted. I could tell Kurt. I could tell him how it feels to be truly loved. I could sit him down and grab him by the shoulders and shake him and just scream at the top of my lungs, "Don't do this. Please don't do this to yourself." But I don't. We don't tell these stories. We don't tell these young men, boys like Kurt or like me, we don't tell them there's hope. Maybe it won't be exactly what you imagine, and maybe no one writes songs about it. Maybe one day you'll see an engagement photo with two tuxedos and just think, wow.
I think there's time for one more character. Jerry, tell us about Brother Walton.
I love Brother Walton because
what?
He's...
Is that right?
I do. I love because he's...
The audience gets a kick out of Walton.
Do they?
He's a
what.
Hoot. Yes. And he's also one of the people in the play that knows Kurt more intimately, more longer in his life. He's friends with his parents. There's a deeper relationship with him, so he's able to be more direct with him. And this is one of the few conversations in the play that is actually direct between the character and Kurt.
Well, and also Walton's that rare, not even rare, that person who's really informed, who knows what he's talking about, but he still chooses to believe. And so there's that cognitive dissonance going on with his character where you're like, well, you're a really smart person. You're really well informed. You're well read.
They own it.
Yeah. Owns the fact that I've heard everything, you know. So yeah, people get a kick out of that because they go, oh yeah, I've talked to that guy too.
Well, let's hear it. This is Brother Walton from Good Standing.
What are you going to tell me, that the Book of Mormon isn't accurate? You think I don't know about the late war, the Napoleon book, all those claims Joseph Smith plagiarized the whole thing? Oh, I've heard it all. The prophets were liars. There were no golden plates. The polygamy was just a scheme for men to cover up their affairs. You think it's going to change my mind? People act like they're missionaries against the church, and they've got their arguments all laid out. But here's the thing. Are they actually trying to save anyone, or do they just want to drop these truth bombs and see the wreckage until all we're left with is ash and disbelief and scholarly analysis? It bugs you, doesn't it, to see how happy we are. Me on the big bad high council, my wife in the Relief Society presidency, two kids on missions, two on the way. I've built my whole life around this thing, this belief system, and you can see how happy we are, and that doesn't make sense, does it? Happiness based on lies. And if these are lies and the books of scripture I hold dear were just copied from some obscure 18th century history textbook, well, then I say God bless the 18th century historian who wrote that textbook. And I say God bless the teachers and the leaders who are always there for me and my family. And I say God bless the millions of church members who choose to believe in something improbable. True, untrue, doesn't matter. Not when you're here. Not when you're happy. And the rest of the world can't stand it that way.
Let me ask you this finally. Matthew Green, you said that Mormonism is, this is how you put it, baked into you like Judaism is baked into Neil Simon, which I liked. And it makes me wonder, do you plan then to continue to explore Mormon themes? What do you think? Do you think you'll keep coming back to these ideas because they're so baked into you?
there are definitely times when I think, okay, let's step away from this for a second. And there are other things that interest me and that I want to write about. But I guess when I say that it's baked into me, and I'm never going to stop writing about Mormon characters and Mormon themes, but when I say it's baked into me, the principles of Mormonism and the pain of Mormonism and the joys of Mormonism and the frustrations and confusions, all of that shows up in just about everything I write, because it's so closely tied to my family. It's so closely tied to my identity, the crises of identity I've gone through. It's closely tied to just how I see the world. So, yeah, Mormonism is always going to show up in everything.
That's Matthew Green. He is the playwright for Good Standing, which Plan B Theater Company is presenting. He joined us from a studio in New York. Matthew Green, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Jerry Rapier directs the play. Jerry, good to see you. Thanks for
thank
being
you.
With us. And Austin Archer, he's the one actor who plays all these 17, what is it, 16 roles?
16 roles.
16 roles. Thank you very much for
Thanks.
Being with us. Good Standing runs through this weekend. You can get the details by just going to our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Holly Vasek. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.